Thank you. Okay, so this day is more or less devoted to the question, what is the nature of quantum space-time? And probably if you ask 10 different people working on quantum gravity, what is the nature of quantum space-time, you will get 15 different answers. So we have multiple models which make different assumptions about what the physical nature of quantum space-time is. And I suppose as long as we don't really probe this experimentally, we won't get a real answer. But remarkably, there's been one common finding in many different approaches, which is that there is dynamical dimensional reduction. So let me briefly explain what I mean by that. So what's the dimension of our universe? Well, we know that at large scales, it's 4, or rather 3 plus 1. But then the question is, what happens at small scales? So the idea that there might be extra dimensions at small scales has been around for a long while. But what emerges from different approaches to quantum gravity actually is kind of the opposite, namely a reduction of dimensionality to some kind of two-dimensionality if we go to small scales. So let me just clarify this a little more, because there are actually different notions of dimensionality. So we know that the topological dimension is one, so a line has topological dimension one, a plane two, and so on. A different notion of dimensionality, and the one that has been probed in all these different approaches, is the spectral dimension. And this is the dimensionality which is probed by a random walker. So I assume I start a random walk here in the origin, I walk around, probe the effect of quantum space-time, and then I have a certain return probability after a time sigma that tells me what is the probability to return to my original point. And obviously, this return probability will depend on the dimensionality. So if I have more dimensions available for my diffusion process, I will not get so far in the same time. So the return probability depends on the dimensionality, and I can define what is called the spectral dimension from this diffusion process. Now, the spectral dimension agrees with the topological dimension if I have a smooth manifold and a regular Brownian motion. And so this means that the spectral dimension will also be 4 at large scales for any quantum gravity approach that agrees with observations in our universe. But now, remarkably, if I go to small scales, the spectral dimension reduces to 2. And I have just a partial list of approaches that have actually seen this result. One is asymptotic safety, where this finding relies on the existence of an interacting fixed point as a direct consequence of that. Causal dynamical triangulations, which construct space-time out of discrete building blocks, also see this result in a phase where they're actually away from the continuum limit, so where they have some kind of discreteness. Now, in loop quantum gravity, you can also make an argument that the spectral dimension reduces to 2. Using the spectrum of the area operator, you can see that it scales as an area at large values of eigenvalues of the spin and scales lower dimensionally at small values. So this can then be used to construct a diffusion process. And the result is also that the spectral dimension goes to 2. And finally, in Hojava-Lifshitz gravity, where you have an anisotropic scaling of space and time and Lorentz symmetry violation, you again reproduce the same result. So I think this is a really remarkable finding, because we have approaches based on very different assumptions about what the physical nature of quantum space-time is, but they all agree on this result. And so this brings me to the list of questions that I have here. The first is this really a generic feature of any theory of quantum gravity? So if it is, it is obviously really, really important to understand what the physical consequences will be. And just to raise some questions that we might maybe discuss a little later, is there any connection of this dimensional reduction, for example, to singularity resolution? Or what happens actually at a black hole singularity or near singularity? More importantly, what happens in the early universe? Does the early universe become two-dimensional in some sense or not? No, or what is the dynamics that happens there? And also, if I put a particle on a quantum space-time, propagating on the space-time, will this propagate in some way as on a two-dimensional space-time? How will this look? How will interactions look? And so on. And this is obviously connected to this question, is there any experimental evidence for the reduction to two dimensions? And I hope that we will hear some of that in the talks, and that we can discuss some of these questions in the discussion session. Any questions so far?
Yes, I can understand why the asymptotic safety scenario implies the reduction of two dimensions.
I think that Martin will answer the question in his talk. So if there are no further questions so far. Yeah?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to make a comment, because Darren and I were just talking, and I think there's a very simple argument, which I'll put in the language of asymptotic safety, but it's very generic. If you're going to have a term in any effective action, you're going to have a term that goes like vial squared. And if there's no dimensional reduction, its coefficient is dimensionless, and perturbation theory holds, it's asymptotically free, and then you have the issue of the ghost pole. To avoid the issue of the ghost pole, if you have dimensional reduction, can avoid the issue of the ghost pole, because then, if naively speaking, the coupling constant becomes dimensional, so it gets a dimensional, gets an anomalous dimension that pushes the pole from zero for asymptotically free to asymptotically safe, and that can let the ghost pole be avoided.
Okay.
And that's
So you would say dimensional reduction is the mechanism to save unitarity.
Yes.
Potentially.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Any further questions or comments? Then I would like to hand.
One comment. I mean, it seems to me that as we just saw in Pachi's talk, it looks like it's clear what these things have in common, because the assumption that the G Newton has the correct scaling dimension is essentially equivalent to the assumption that there's a minimum landscape, L Planck. But the other minimum landscape means square root of GP goes to a constant, which means the scaling of D equal 2. So is that such a surprise?
Maybe not, but
it's just the assumption that there's Planck lands.
Yeah, so but in that you know, then we should really establish that you can really derive from the existence of a minimal length that there has to be dimensional reduction.
That's what Roberto just showed us. That you know, the running tells you, you know, in order to have a minimum length, you need to have a special type of running. So that's essentially what Roberto did, in fact, you know, a long time ago. And I think his argument is already in his paper of, you know, six or seven years ago. So it's not surprising.
In the case of asymptotic safety, we will hear that it's the running of the cosmological constant which is responsible for this mechanism and not the running of G. But maybe we can discuss this more after Martin's talk.
Is it on? So let me start the discussion of dimensional reduction in general, or to be precise, dynamical dimensional reduction from the perspective of asymptotic safety. And let's see then whether or not we can make contact with other approaches like, for instance, simulations. Now, my favorite theory of quantum gravity is asymptotic safety, and the favorite implementation is in terms of the effective average action. And so I would like to just start with one transparency where I put or lay down the framework in which all these discussions of dimensional reductions in the case of asymptotic safety was formulated, and that is this idea of a running effective field theory. The effective average action for the, if you don't know it, for the purposes of this talk, is just a family, a one-parameter family of running action functionals for the metric tensor. So gamma of G mu nu is the ordinary effective action, which corresponds to infrared cutoff k equals zero. And here you have a generalization of this ordinary notion to effective theories, which are, vaguely speaking, valid at arbitrary scales between zero and infinity. Now, given such an infinite set of field theories, you can ask, for instance, what's the expectation value of the metric obtained as the stationary point of a running field equation, if you like. Delta gamma k by delta g mu nu has a stationary point, but g mu nu at scale k, this is a valid or a solution to the field equation at scale k. So it gives you a kind of mean field which describes space-time at this scale. So leaving aside all technical details of how you introduce or how you compute this family of effective actions, what is obvious is that if you are given a kind of bare space-time manifold M, which is just a differentiable, say, manifold without a metric structure, then this setting equips one and the same bare space-time M with an infinite set of Riemannian structures. This is what in this context we call then quantum space-time. It's one manifold equipped with a scale-dependent metric, or stated differently, with infinitely many metrics. So what do you learn from that? Well, first of all, this overall setting is without any interest unless there is a physical mechanism that really makes those theories different one from another. And if you know that this gamma k is the solution to some sort of functional renormalization group equation, it becomes clear that the dynamics that changes gamma from one scale to another is driven by quantum fluctuations. So if you have strong quantum fluctuations, you expect these theories to differ as you go from one scale to another. Let me illustrate that by a very simple approximation, truncation, the first one to be used, the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, where you approximate gamma k by a running Einstein-Hilbert action with a running cosmological constant and a running Newton constant. In this simple truncation, this effective field equation assumes the form of the ordinary Einstein equation, but with a running cosmological constant. In absence of matter, the Newton constant drops out. So this dimension full lambda, this was Roberto's lambda tilde before, the dimension less lambda is the lambda tilde of before in my case is defined in this way. The dimension full is k squared times the dimension less. This is one coordinate of theory space here, and the other one is the dimension less Newton constant, Roberto's G tilde. And then we have computed the flow in this two-dimensional theory space, and what one finds is, for instance, trajectories like this one, emanating from a non-Gaussian fixed point, spiraling around it, then going close to this point, the origin, the Gaussian fixed point, and then finally approaching large positive values of lambda. Now, this is in dimension less units, all these plots. So what you have here close to the non-Gaussian fixed point is a running of the dimension full lambda like k squared. This is the regime Roberto was discussing here. Then as you go away a little bit, then you enter a semi-classical regime. There, the running is approximately k to the d. When you are in d classical dimensions, then here at the turning point, you go over to the classical regime, and down here, that's where we live about, the running stops. But the running of Newton's constant stops already here, of the cosmological constant only here at the turning point. And on Monday, we discussed already, if you fit this kind of trajectory derived from pure gravity, if you fit it to the lambda and g value measured in the real universe, then the Planckian cutoff scale is about here. The turning point is at the micrometer scale, and the Hubble scale, 10 to the minus 60, is about here. Okay, so please keep this in mind, but the green parts are more or less just to guide the intuition that's not important. Now, let's first of all focus on the fixed point regime. There you can show that the expectation, well, you're just looking at this equation, that the expectation value of the metric scales as 1 over k squared. So the metric scales as 1 over k squared. So when you increase the cutoff, it goes down with its canonical dimension, namely minus 2.
What does that mean precisely? These are the components of a tensor. So in which coordinates do the components scale like?
In any, it's just the solution to this equation. And if this thing here scales like k squared by simply by dimensional analysis, you learn that the solution to that equation scales like 1 over gamma. That's basically because the Einstein tensor, the contracted Einstein tensor, scales like mass squared. So this holds at every point x. So there is no cutoff identification involved. This is a totally safe prediction. Now, what we showed already a long time ago is that this very fast running, that it leads, first of all, to something like self-similarity. You can also show, that is what Astrid alluded to, that the effective dimensionality as defined as the naive dimension plus the anomalous dimension of Newton's constant. This is the quantity that governs the fall-off behavior of the graviton propagator. This effective dimensionality related to the cutoff propagator, related to the behavior of the running Newton constant, this drops to the value 2. And what one also can show, and I'm going into some details of this derivation, is that the spectral dimension in the same regime goes to the value d over 2. This matches in precisely 4 classical dimensions, and I think this rules out some of the points raised before. So what we have here is the definition of the spectral dimension. Gamma is the bare metric. Delta gamma is the Laplace-Beltrami operator in that metric. And the trace is a functional trace. And the brackets are the average or the expectation value in the sense of the path integral, quantum gravity path integral. And this is the definition of the spectral dimension dS. Now, what we could deduce from this result and also from the other scaling regimes, I mean, long ago already, was this qualitative picture, non-Gaussian fixed point regime 2, classical regime 4, and in between there is a relatively complicated semi-classical regime. The behavior here depends on the precise trajectory chosen. The asymptotes here are the same for all trajectories. Now, this has had interesting points of contact with various simulations. The one on CDT by Ampion, Jurkiewicz, and Loll in 4 dimensions, who found a drop of roughly 4 to 2. Dario's work with Joe Hansen on 3-dimensional simulations, which showed a drop from 3 to 2, which was not quite our expectation. And very recent EDT, Euclidean dynamical triangulation simulations, from 4 to something like 1.5. Well, EDT has been abandoned in the early 90s because it was claimed that people see no continuum limit, but now this group in Scotland revived these simulations. They claim with a different kind of measure they can reach the continuum. And I will comment on their results in a moment. Then there had also been these other comparisons or these other evaluations of spectral dimensions in loop quantum gravity, the spatial sections are spin foams by Leonardo, for instance, and it was something similar, 3 to 2 with the intermediate 1.5 regime, or 3D spin foams, 3 to 2 with the intermediate 1.5 regime. So this is all very taken with a grain of salt. I only show these results because of this intermediate results of these intermediate values, which are even lower than the asymptotic ones, which is 2 or 1.5 respectively. Now, our own recent interest was triggered by the following observation. After the 4D simulations had been done and the spectral dimensions had been measured there by the Utrecht, Copenhagen, Krakow group, it was realized, or these people realized, that their Planck length is still pretty large, or let's say their lattice spacing is still pretty large in Planck units. About one lattice spacing was about 2 Planck lengths. At that scale, we, from the continuum perspective, never would have expected the asymptotic scaling, never expected the host, the spectral dimension 2. And so to us, it was somewhat a mystery how it could be claimed that in the simulations you could observe a spectral dimension 2, even though you are pretty far away from the continuum limit, or what was our understanding of the asymptotic scaling regime. And so more recently with Frank Zauer-Essig, we reconsidered these running spectral dimensions in more quantitative terms. What we did is to introduce a kind of running exponent. If lambda runs like k to the delta with a very slow k dependence of this exponent, then you can show that the spectral dimensions, if the dependence of k is small enough, is something like this 2d over 2 plus delta. So in the classical regime, you have delta equals 0 and the spectral dimension equals the classical one. In the semi-classical one, instead, you have delta equals d, which is 4, for instance, and the spectral one, according to this formula, is 4/3, which is even smaller than 2, or 2d over 2 plus d is even smaller than the asymptotic value d over 2. And in the non-Gaussian fixed-point regime, we have delta equals 2 and ds is d over 2. This is what I mentioned before. Now, there is a very nice way of visualizing these results. Namely, if you return to the G lambda plot, you can draw a line here, which is the point where one of the two beta functions, namely the one of the cosmological constant, vanishes. This is this purple line. So the turning points of every trajectory lie on that line, in particular the last one, but also the other ones forming the spirals. And above the purple line, ds is always smaller than d over 2. Below, it's always bigger than d over 2. So in the example of interest, smaller than 2 dimensions and larger than 2 dimensions. In particular, here in the classical regime, we have 4. But now, the funny point is, here, very close to the ultraviolet fixed point, everybody expects the value 2. It's actually true that here is the value is 2, but also down here, the value is 2. And remember what I said about the fits to the real value in nature. This is Planck scale, and this scale down here is 10 to the minus 30 Planck scales. So what we claim, or what we find, is that dimension 2 in pure gravity, you see not only asymptotically, but the lowest instance where you see it is at a scale as macroscopic as a few microns in pure gravity. That's important to emphasize. So in particular, when you squeeze this point, the turning point, very close to the origin close to the Gaussian fixed point, then the trajectory spends a long time here in the semi-classical regime, then you get a long, 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 long classical regime. That's what we need for phenomenology. And then your trajectory gives rise to this curve for the scale-dependent spectral dimension. You have a plateau at 4, the classical one. Then you cross 2, go below, go to 4/3. Then you are in a second plateau, basically here, the semi-classical one at 4/3. And then come the oscillations and you approach the value of the fixed point regime, which is 2. And by virtue of this little formula and the overall k dependence of ds, we could match Dario's Monte Carlo data, which he gave to us, with our predictions. And it turned out, really, by comparing Monte Carlo data to our prediction, that the three-dimensional simulations are about here. And this is, I mean, these figures here, 4 and 2 is for 4 macroscopic dimensions. This is 1.5 for 3 dimensions. And in this vicinity here is the best the present simulations can do. But you see, it's a dimension pretty much smaller than 4, but it is still far from the continuum limit. The same analysis we could do also with the four-dimensional ones, but with a fit formula. And so the overall conclusion is that the present simulations are somewhere here. So the excitement of about 5 years ago, when it was claimed that we see two dimensions, CDT seems two dimensions, was, so to speak, for a wrong reason. It is accidentally 2 and 2, but it's not the same 2. So the conclusion is, I think this is the main message of this talk, the main message and the main importance of spectral dimension computations for the time being is that it is a very beautiful ideal diagnostic tool to check how far simulations or discrete approaches are away from the continuum limit. And the reason is why I say other approaches and not say nature. The reason is, by its very definition, the spectral dimension refers to test particles. And to our colleagues doing simulations, I can tell switch off the back reaction, but I cannot tell to nature. So in nature, we always have to deal with possible back reactions. And this causes a severe question mark as to whether it is possible to answer these questions in the affirmative, because you saw quite explicitly in this effective Einstein equation, to get this, in particular, this strong 4/3 depression, you need a very, very, so to speak, rapid response of space-time to scale changes, a very rapidly scaling cosmological constant. And as soon as you have matter, you will never get that. Or typically, you will never get that unless, by accident, the matter part scales like k^4. So when you have condensates or all that, you will not see it. That's why I'm not saying that at the millimeter scale in real nature, you are going two-dimensional or 4/3 dimensional. And also there are all these other problems related to the non-trivial vacuum structure we talked about in the discussion already. So the need is for fully dressed graviton propagators and matter propagators in these non-trivial vacuum structures. Only after having managed to do that, we are able to basically answer these questions about nature. And this is something we are not even able doing in QCD. Just think of computing with paper and pencil the gluon propagator at at 1 MeV, say, in QCD. If you know how difficult that is, you will imagine that this is certainly not... But not with paper and pencil. But this is the good point. And in QCD we have simulations. And so an important point is to make contact with simulations to show analytic approaches. And the simulations are in the same universality class. We are talking about the same things. And if so, then we can attack such problems with very different and much more efficient tools, maybe, than the analytic calculations. Thank you.
So I think this is a very important idea, but let me, as you're pointing towards physics, let me ask a physical question. If the propagators for, say, photons show the influence of dimensional reduction in high energy, then that'll signal itself as non-trivial dispersion relations, right? The relationship.
This is totally unclear, because this is what I indicated here. We don't know what happens if you perturb the pure quantum gravity vacuum with a propagating photon.
Mark, reason naively. I mean, the dispersion relations are different in different dimensions. And if the most naive thing, I just want to make a simple point, the most naive thing to expect is that the effect of dimensional reduction will be to modify the dispersion relations. And then the important question is whether the dimensional reduction manifests itself in a modified dispersion relation in a way that breaks rotational and Lorentz and translation symmetry, or in a way that deforms those symmetries. And I think that given that there's a lot of experimental sensitivity to the breaking or to deformation of those symmetries at the Planck scale, as we've been learning from the experimentalists, this could be a route to connect the notion of reduced dimension to experiment without having to do a big computer simulation and so
on. No, but it depends on the vacuum on which you propagate. Because the vacuum structure, remember this lasagna picture Alfio showed?
Yeah. So that itself is that itself that lasagna vacuum structure certainly looks like the continuous symmetries of nature are broken, and that again, I mean, I think the message from all the experimentalists and the cosmologists is that this great experimental symmetry at the great experimental sensitivity at the Planck scale to the breaking or deformation of the continuous symmetries as well as the parity. So there is, I'm trying to say something optimistic, there's an avenue, it's perhaps not rigorous at this point, but there's an avenue to connect the idea of reduced dimensionality with experimental tests.
Maybe, but there is a lot of, all I'm saying is I have no prejudice about the final answer. I'm just saying there is a lot of homework to do before we can...
It seems that in a paper by Visser, Sotirio, and by Fulmer, there is an attempt to make this intuition that we explain rigorous somehow.
Which intuition?
I'm studying it right now.
Somebody has studied the special dimension for the low seven dimensions, yeah.
So they really try to establish a link between dispersion relations and spectral dimensions. I don't know what could be the loopholes.
Well, my confusion about this is that if you look at the low energy theories of all these companies, he's saying that there's this universality of behavior. But the symmetries, for example, of Hadrava Lipschitz are very different intrinsically than the symmetry of asymptotic safety. So, Leo, I'm questioning you, do you have an intuition that it should be unique?
No.
That's really the question. Are there a large class of theories and something else is going on here to actually give the dimensional reduction?
It would be nice if there was something universal, but I don't have a... I'm making a much weaker point, which is that however it turns out in whatever theory, it seems that it has to affect the dispersion relations, and through that the symmetries, and through that is an open window to experiment.
Okay.
I mean, I just would say, I would like to say a word of warning about just talking about dimension and dimensional reduction. It depends on what kind of dimension you think of. For instance, if you are not in four dimensions, then d plus eta, the anomalous dimension or the generalized dimension that controls the propagator fall off, does not agree with the spectral dimension. D plus eta is always 2. When you start from 3 classical dimensions, the propagator thinks space-time is two-dimensional at high energies, the graviton propagator. But the spectral dimension, this is what explains or encodes what this random walker, the random walk test particle thinks about space-time. That test particle thinks space-time is 1.5-dimensional. And there are many more other notions of dimensions, generalizing the classical notion of dimension, that apply at the same time. For instance, the walk dimension, fractal.
But again, just to talk naively, you know, if you look at condensed matter models with fractal dimensions, they break translation symmetry, and they break rotational symmetry.
Yes.
So I'm not trying to say something profound. I'm just saying there's an expectation that reduced dimensions should come with it, either modified, either deformed, that is nonlinear realizations of symmetries, or just broken symmetries. And this is something which should be investigated.
Yes, of course. We are going
okay.
In this.
Are there further questions or remarks? Maybe if not as a chair, I get to ask the last question. This is also a question for Dario and CBTs. So the current spectral dimension is deduced from a random walk that doesn't respect any kind of light form structure. So a bit closer to what would be a test particle really propagating on a space-time would be a random walk that does actually respect the light form structure and stays within the light form. Do you have any idea first of all, this would be feasible, for example, to do in the CDT, and also what you would expect for the spectral dimension defined from this causal random walk, what the result should be?
What do you define the return probability if you go?
You can just go in the rest frame of a reference particle and say when does it come back to this point?
Well, I don't know. The CDT usually, but I don't think it's a Euclidean. So I'm defining light cones.
But you have different
things.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You could have a causal suction, yeah.
But I wouldn't expect that to be much different. I mean, the continuum, we don't. I mean, there's no difference. The Lorentzian or the Euclidean, and then the spectral dimension is something which is independent.
But the on CDT, the structure of the spatial slices is quite different from space-time. So if you look only at the spatial slice, it has even like 1.5 or something. Mm-hmm. So if you only look at causal steps, you would only see would see much less from the spatial slices, would see more in time direction.
This is, by the way, is also a very important point.
It's a bit anisotropic.
Yes, you mentioned the Hausdorff dimension. The Hausdorff dimension of slices and of the entire space-time in CDT is very different from 4 and 3, respectively. Very different. But in our case, in the continuum, the Hausdorff dimension is always 4. We formulate everything on a naive continuum space-time, and this is also another word of warning. There are so many different notions of dimensions that apply to different generalizations of the concept of dimension. So in what Bianca said, in this issue of comparing the dimensionality of time slices versus that of the entire space-time, it makes a big difference whether you talk about Hausdorff and take Hausdorff from simulations versus the spectral ones.
Okay. I think in the interest of lunch, we should close this part of the discussion on this note of caution and move to our next speakers. this talk, we will take a more optimistic view of how this might actually manifest itself in experiments.
That's great.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you something about vanishing dimensions, which is work that I've done in collaboration with various people here. And the work was actually publicized, featured in Nature editorial. Collider gets yet more exotic to-do list. So this is the outline of the talk. I will not have time for any introduction. So instead, I will go straight to the proposal of evolving dimensions, that our universe is lower dimensional on short scales and higher dimensional on large scales. And I mean literally. I don't mean spectral dimension, effective dimensionality, fractal, topological. I mean literally, literal dimension. So I will tell you the motivation for the proposal, possible evidence that may already exist, potential problems, and experimental signatures. So the current wisdom in the high energy physics today is to make the things more complicated at high energies or shorter distances, to introduce extra dimensions, new particles, new structures, and then hope that the problems will miraculously cancel out or disappear. Instead, we can think outside of the box, and we just might win in a way that nobody expects. So in our proposal, contrary to the standard wisdom, we propose that instead of more dimensions at short scales, spaces actually lower dimensional. On medium scales, it has to be three-dimensional, as we all know. But on large scales, it can become higher dimensional. For example, this is an example of a structure that is fundamentally one-dimensional. So it's a string. It's a lower dimensional object. But it intersects itself many, many times. So when you look at this structure from a large distance, low resolution, it looks like a two-dimensional plane, but actually, fundamentally, it's a one-dimensional object, and you're going to see that only when you have high enough energy, high enough resolution. Of course, it's always easier to work with regular structures, like an ordered lattice. So this is an example of a structure which is one-dimensional on scales smaller than L1. It's two-dimensional on scales from L1 and L2, and three-dimensional on scales between L2 and L3. And this hierarchy doesn't have to stop. You could be opening more and more dimensions with increasing length scale. So a particle with a very short wavelength, so very high frequency, will be probing actually one-dimensional space. Particle with a wavelength like this will be probing two-dimensional space. Particle with a wavelength like this will be probing three-dimensional. Even larger cosmological scales, perturbations on cosmological scales will be probing actually higher-dimensional space, and so on and so on. The nice thing about this proposal is that nature already builds structures like this. So this is an example of graphene, much higher material in condensed matter. So this structure is one-dimensional on scales shorter than L1. It's two-dimensional on scales greater than L1, but shorter than L2, and three-dimensional on scales and L3 and higher. But why? I mean, what's the benefit that we are getting? What do we gain by having less dimensions at higher energy? The first thing that crosses our mind is, of course, the hierarchy problem in the standard model. So if you calculate the corrections to the Higgs mass within the standard model, they're quadratically divergent, but they're quadratically divergent only in three dimensions, three spatial dimensions. In two dimensions, they are linearly divergent, which is much healthier than this, but then in one dimension, they are logarithmically divergent. So even if I trust my standard model all the way to M Planck, logarithm of 19 orders of magnitude is just 19, so I don't care that much. Instead of fine-tuning 19 orders of magnitude, I'm fine-tuning one order of magnitude or less. So if dimensional crossover happens at a TV scale, so if I go from 3D to 2D at a TV scale, and then as soon as after that from 2D to 1D, then the hierarchy problem will disappear, and there will be no need for new physics, just the standard model. So as long as LHC doesn't find any new particles, then this will be favored with respect to the supersymmetry or extra dimensions or anything that predicts new particles that we haven't seen so far. I don't think I don't have to convince anybody here that gravity in lower dimensions is much simpler than in three dimensions. So in 2+1 dimensions, there are no local gravitational degrees of freedom. Problem of non-renormalizability disappears. If I go even, oh, sorry, one slide in between. There are no real singularities in two plus one dimensions. There are conical singularities, but not true space-time singularities. So maybe that will affect our understanding of the information loss paradox, as Astrid mentioned in the introduction. If we go even further to 1+1 dimensions, gravity probably stops being general relativity because the action is just the Euler characteristic, so it's not dynamical. If I vary this, I'm not going to get any dynamical equation. Unless I augment it by some scalar field, so these are known as, these models are known as dilaton gravity, but even they are completely integrable and quantizable. What do I gain if I have more dimensions and large scales? So the first thing that crosses our mind again is cosmological constant problem. So an exact solution in 4+1 dimensional Einstein's general relativity looks like this, one of the possible solutions, one that I will be concentrating on. So this is the extra dimension. Psi is the extra coordinate in the extra dimension. This is our homogeneous and isotropic FRW universe. This is the time coordinate. And we get this exponential factor for free. But this exponential factor actually depends on our location in a higher dimensional universe. But if you use that analogy with the ordered lattice, we live on one slice in a higher dimensional universe. So if you live on one slice, you fix the value of psi. And that will be the value of your effective cosmological constant. So five-dimensional theory is empty, so it's a vacuum solution. This is a vacuum solution. But fifth dimension will cast a shadow on a slice that we live on, and it will look, that shadow will look like a cosmological constant. What is very nice here, that if you want to get the value of the cosmological constant that you measure, then you have to fix the value of psi, which is 10 to the 60 M Planck inverse, which is just the horizon scale. So if you open the fourth dimension at the horizon scale, you get a cosmological constant of about 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. And other large scale puzzles that we have in cosmology, like bulk flow, which is large scale coherent motion in one direction, or axis of evil, or lack of CMB power on large scales, could be just physics of large wavelength excitations on the lattice, because our universe is actually four-dimensional large scales, but we are probing just a few of these slices. So we live on one of these slices. So galaxies, solar system, these are still three-dimensional, but we just started discovering the fourth dimension if we studied the large wavelength excitations on cosmological scales. But okay, how do particles propagate in such a background? So you put a particle on your ordered lattice, and then obviously there are many different paths from two macroscopically separated points. But that looks like a Feynman path integral. So due to quantum fluctuations, particle follows a jagged path always. On average, classically, we do get straight a classical trajectory, but that's because of interference of many possible paths. So the phases cancel out and you end up only with a classical straight path between two points. So in our case, it's not going to be quantum fluctuations. It's going to be geometry of the lattice that dictates the jaggedness of a path. So when you talk about the geometry of the lattice, you have several choices. So you can either have a natural lattice in which lower dimensional blocks are just building higher dimensional lattice, or you can have a stack of brains like this, membranes, or you can have a random lattice like this. So these planes could be randomly oriented towards each other. In all of these cases, short distance physics is two-dimensional or one-dimensional, but the way one recovers the three dimensions on large scale is not the same. So the situation that I prefer is the random lattice, and the reason is that it avoids preferred direction in space, so it avoids systematic violations of Lorentz invariance. The preferred reference system still exists. That's the frame of the lattice, but it's no more problematic than the preferred reference system of the CMB. Now, the most important potential problem here is the Lorentz invariance violation. So in principle, if you have discrete space-time, the effective speed of light might change on such a background. So if you have two simultaneously emitted photons with certain energy difference, they will arrive at the observer with a certain time delay. And of course, that time delay will depend on the distance. And we have a famous result by Fermi satellite. So Fermi observed the gamma ray burst at about 1 billion light years from us. Fermi observed one photon of 31 GeV and another one of 3 GeV, and they arrive with a time delay of less than 1 second, and this is very often cited as a limit on the scale at which you can violate Lorentz invariance to be greater than M Planck. Ooh, I have to hurry up very quickly. Okay, good. What's the problem with this result? That only one event is observed. Physics of the source is poorly understood. A limit that quantum that energy scale at which you can violate Lorentz invariance should be greater than M Planck is valid only if linear corrections exist, which is not always true. In this context, which is very important here, both of the photons were GeV photons, so none of them were above the TeV. If dimensional crossover happens at the TeV, in order to really probe the violations, one of the photons should propagate above TeV, so it should see two dimensional space time, fine structure, and another one should propagate below the TeV, so it should see three dimensions. Then you compare these two photons, then you say, oh, there is a discrepancy in the speed at which they propagate. But even in principle, that's a problem. Even when we have experiments that probe that, then TeV photons, their interaction probability for interaction probability of a photon with a CMB photon and infrared background photons becomes so high that we are going to lose most of these things as they are propagating from a distant point in space towards us. Moreover, discrete structures don't have to violate the Lorentz invariance, and I think Raphael Sorkin is going to talk about that either later today or tomorrow. So the point is in randomization. So if you have a regular lattice, then such a lattice looks differently in two different reference systems. But if you have a sprinkled lattice, so if the structure is random, then one can tell in which frame was used to produce the sprinkling. Approximation is equally good in any frame. Perhaps Sabine will disagree with that, but okay, we'll see about it later. But the point that I would like to make here is that we simply cannot take the limits of Lorentz invariance violation face value. That the energy scale at which it's violated is greater than M Planck. It's just too good to be true. We simply don't understand how particles interact with space-time structure at the fundamental level. We are always using that semi-classical intuition, but whenever we are using it, we get confused, like information loss paradox, for example. Finally, 10 to the 19 GeV. That number doesn't even make sense in 2D. So it makes sense in 3D because you know what's the value of G in 3D. You plug it there and you get the number. In 2D, if your fundamental theory is lower dimensional, then fundamental M Planck is this. But this should be two-dimensional G. We never measure that. So if gravity really becomes two-dimensional at higher energies, we have to do the experiment, the tabletop experiment, measure the value of G in two dimensions, then plug it there and get the value of, value of M Planck. Meaning that if the fundamental theory is lower dimensional, M Planck could be much lower or much higher than 10 to the 19 GeV. So maybe those higher order Lorentz invariance violating operators, they are suppressed by infinite value of M Planck. Maybe they don't show up. Who knows? Okay. If you want a concrete model, I'm running out of time. I'm not going to talk about this string theory concrete model. This solution has been already derived, and I didn't derive it. But I'm currently working with several people, with Niyash in particular, about this model. So in string theory, or it doesn't even have to be a string theory. So if you have a manifold with a metric, G mu nu, in a target space, and you have a metric on a subspace, which is gamma alpha beta, then these x mu's are actually dimensions that we observe in the world. These are coordinates in a big space. But they're also dynamical fields on a world sheet. So kinetic term could be just the standard Nambu-Goto action. But then we can add it a mass term. I can add a mass term to my dimensions. If this mass term is energy dependent, then in early universe, these dimensions may not be excited at all. Only as, I will need like two more minutes than that. Oh, 1.5. Okay, no, 2 more minutes plus that 1 minute. Okay, I will hurry up. So I just want to point out that you can cook up a model in which dimensions open up as the energy goes down. So at the beginning, you don't have dimensions. Then you excite one dimension. Then you excite two dimensions. Then you excite three dimensions. Today, at 10 to the minus 3 eV, three dimensions are excited. But this doesn't have to stop. As the energy goes down, you can excite all 10 or 11 dimensions that you want. Then there is no need for compactification. There is no 10 to the 500 vacuum, and so on and so on. Experimental evidence may already exist for this. So now I really have to hurry up, so I'm just going to mention. So Pamir experiment is the first that showed that the alignment of secondary cosmic rays. So the primary cosmic rays hits a particle in the atmosphere. You get the secondary showers. If the cross-section of that beam, of that shower of particles, is a circle, then that's a 3D event. If that cross-section starts degenerating into an ellipse, that's somewhat planar event that you measure with this parameter lambda. And if it is completely degenerated into a line, that's a pure two-dimensional event. It looks like particles propagate on a plane rather than in 3D. Pamir and Mount Kabala measured the alignment of about 0.6 to 0.8, but two stratospheric experiments, the Russian stratospheric balloon and the experiment on the Concorde flight, measured the alignment of 0.99, so almost perfectly two-dimensional propagation of particles. The point is that you have to catch the shower high up in the atmosphere. If you do an experiment on the sea level, the energy of the showers degrades. You are never going to see this alignment. You have to put your detector up and catch the very beginning of the shower. If that's not a fluke, then LHC must see the same thing. So independently of what's your Lagrangian, if physics become two-dimensional at the LHC, you should see the cross-section that is changing because of the reduced phase space. In two dimensions, you have less phase space than in three dimensions. Higher order scattering processes at high energy become planar, and jets of sufficiently high energy may become elliptic in shape. So let me just go straight to the point. So the cross-section is not a disk. The cross-section is a line. That will reduce the cross-section. The cross-section will drop as e to the 3 rather than e to the square for electromagnetic processes, Drell-Young processes, which were very well studied at the Tevatron. So from the Tevatron data, you can find actually the limit. If there is dimensional crossover, it cannot happen at energies smaller than 800 GeV. Very important point to mention here is that in 3D, so these are the jets. They are coming out of the process that happened at the LHC. It doesn't have to be LHC, any collider. In three dimensions, any three jets, any three vectors, they don't have to be in a plane. If you see coplanar three jets, that's a signature that the physics is planar. Of course, there is one caveat. In the center of mass frame, even in 3D, this is impossible because you have to cancel the momentum. So even in 3D, three jets are coplanar, so the fun will start with four jets. Coplanar four jets at the LHC will be a clear signature that physics is two-dimensional rather than, I'm almost done, the two-dimensional, the three-dimensional. Another thing is elliptic jets, meaning that the jet starts planar right after the collision, but then it starts branching into three dimensions. But then the cross-section is not a circle, it's actually an ellipse, as it is in those cosmic ray experiments. So that's another signature that you can look for at the LHC. And actually, some people at ATLAS are seriously taking these claims. So they published already a paper where they measured the event shapes at large momentum transfer. And so far, they haven't found any discrepancy from the standard model. But if we believe the cosmic ray experiments, the crossover should happen at 4 TeV, not at 1 TeV. So there are still very few events, much smaller number of events at 4 TeV. Center of mass energy is 4 TeV. Each particle should have 4 TeV, and the mediator has to have 4 TeV for a event to be planar completely. This is the very last thing. So if there is dimension and crossover in early universe, when the universe was hotter than TeV, then at certain point we should stop having gravity waves, because in 2Ds there are no gravity waves. So huge energy densities, fluctuations in early universe produce gravity waves. Those gravity waves redshift with expansion of the universe. This function tells you the frequency of the gravity wave that was produced at this scale. If you plot this versus LISA sensitivity, you see that LISA should be able to see the gravitational, the crossover in dimensions if the transition happens between 1 and 100 TeV. NGO will be shorter than LISA, but sensitivity scales is a square root of length. So instead of 5 million kilometers, we're going to have 1 million kilometers. That is going to change just like a factor of 2. It's not going to drastically change anything. So this is the conclusion. Fundamental problems have accumulated, certainly. Current ideas don't work. It's time for radically new ideas. We introduce the concept of evolving dimensions. Many problems simply disappear if dimensions reduce. And what remains to be done is concrete model or Lagrangian that we are working on. Sorry for going over.
Thank you. You already know that I'm skeptic that you can avoid the limits of noise invariance violation, though it's hard to say if you don't have a concrete model. But I was confused about something you said, which was you showed the sprinkling from the causal sets. But this is, these are points in four dimensions.
Yeah, these are planes. Yeah,
and
that's
different. What you need is you need two-dimensional.
I agree.
Right. So
I agree.
How do you think this connection is supposed to work?
No, of course I don't have calculations for that. Of course, the only thing that you expect is that general idea that if those planes are randomly oriented towards each other. So when you drew this thing, if you average over only three planes or five planes, Lorentz invariance violation will be big. But if you average over many, 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 many planes, then the Lorentz invariance violation will be tiny. I mean, that's equivalent to saying, like,
but
okay.
My suspicion is that if you do this and you average over all of these planes and they have to be, you can't cut them off because then you would introduce some scale that would break Lorentz invariance. It would just be space filling. And you have produced four dimensions.
In order to recover it completely, it will be space filling. But in order to get some, to push them beyond the limit, the observable limit, then probably it has to be finite. Where exactly, I'm not sure. But then again, I made that slide, actually, in which I complain that we cannot be taking these limits face value. They are too good to be true. So they may be true, but I would say we don't understand how the particles propagate on quantum background.
Can I have some more questions for us?
Yeah.
On large scales, wouldn't you expect to see this dimensional reduction in the number counts of galaxies and clusters of galaxies and quasars
right.
out in the universe,
yes.
which seems to match Friedman, Robertson, Walker?
No. So as I showed on that slide, when you extrapolate that ordered lattice, all of the galaxies, okay, solar system, galaxies, everything is on one slice. So whatever you measure with galaxies, it's going to be three-dimensional. On scales which are almost horizon scales, you're going to start discovering 4D effects, meaning that one of the consequences is cosmological constant. So that's something that you are already observing. There is another thing. Niyash wrote a paper, actually, with Justin Corey, that some of the data actually have much better fit if you have four dimensions than three dimensions. I mean, 4+1 rather than 3+1. So in large scales, you are starting hitting problems. That's the whole point of this proposal. We understand physics between TV inverse and horizon scales. We don't understand it shorter than TV. We don't understand it higher than almost at the horizon scales. So that's where you have to modify your physics and your ideas in order to get new avenues for the solution.
You said we should try to avoid Lorentz violation, Lorentz invariance violation.
Yes.
And we do that by averaging.
Yeah.
But if you take the view that cosmological scales are associated with a certain length.
Yes.
That calculation of this length is done in a particular frame. So you are taking.
Yeah, yeah. CMB frame is the preferred frame. Yeah.
Right. So at one point there is a preferred frame at the cosmological scale, and then somehow the preferred frame disappears because we average over lattices.
Oh no. Okay. Preferred frame says that the time-like direction is preferred. So that's right. I don't want my space-like direction to be preferred. So I don't want to break isotropy of CMB. So I don't want that stack of brains.
I thought you wanted to do this by averaging.
Yes. Yeah, that's okay. That's fine. No, that's still fine. No, but I don't understand what's the problem here. So I want to avoid, for example, though
the problem is the following. When you say I have a certain scale, I have
right.
to see with the universe
yes.
a certain scale. That is in a preferred frame.
Yes.
And you say when we go beyond this scale, we will go to the horizon or beyond the horizon scale, then we will see the effects of four dimensions.
Yeah, but
that is associated with the with this preferred frame.
No,
but
right.
We shouldn't have a preferred frame because we should average over all the possible
orientations. No, but when you are averaging, right, that's the point. That's the point. When I average over three-dimensional slices, which are comprising four-dimensional universe, I don't have many of them, so I'm gonna see some strange effects. But if I take one three-dimensional slice and I dissect it, that thing is made of many two-dimensional slices. Now I want to average over many two-dimensional planes so that I'm not seeing anything strange in my three dimensions. If I see something strange on large scales, I want that, because I want to address cosmological problem from that point of view. But I don't want to change anything in the lab, anything that has been tested very well. So when I average 2D planes, I want a lot of 2D planes to average out so that my 3D space is recovered properly. But when I average 3D slices in 4D, I just don't have too many of them, because I just started discovering four dimension. So I just have several 3D planes making up 4D lattice, which is big.
Okay. One short question for lunch.
Well, so if you're saying these 4D effects are starting to show up in horizon scales, now wouldn't that introduce anisotropy in the microwave background?
Axis of evil. okay. You are not going to introduce, okay. CMB, energy at which CMB was formed is 1 EV. The dimensional crossover happened at a TV. So CMB was, when CMB was created, the physics was already 3D. So no danger from that point of view. The only thing is that now, when that CMB photon is going to reach you from very large distances, then you might see things like it's not here. Then you must see deviations. Then you might see deviations like this. No, it wasn't. See, okay. We have to distinguish again 2D to 3D crossover from 3D to 4D crossover. When the CMB was formed, it wasn't like a plane that introduced one preferred direction, because that happened at a TeV. Universe was too hot. When CMB formed, there was one EV. At one EV, universe was already 3D. No anisotropy at the time when it was created. It wasn't one plane. It was a lot of planes. But where you can get an effect is that when that CMB photon is now trying to reach you from cosmological distances, you might see there is one preferred direction, slightly preferred, not terribly preferred. That's the alignment. It could be. That's what I'm hinting here. It's just a throwaway argument that on large scales, we are starting seeing anomalies that don't quite match up the FRW, the standard FRW model. So I'm just saying that excitations, long wavelength excitations of this lattice could be those anomalies that we are seeing.
Is there any question that is so urgent that it can't be
later? Very small problem. I'm not sure, but I think that the axis of lead evil, it's not there anymore. It's now.
It depends.
Okay.
Lack of power on large scales, it is still there. Axis of evil, more or less. Bulk flow probably is not there.
Actually,
I've written the paper on it.
Nobody believes anymore. Anyway.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker again.